to live righteously.
It's time for another episode of the Cultural Hall, and it is episode number 253, and just a minute we'll talk with our friend Jason Wright. I'm going to find out what the F stands for, so I'm excited about that. But first, if you have not gone online to whether you get your podcasts at iTunes or you get them through the Google Play Store, give us a review if you would. If you do not follow us on all the social medias you use, go ahead and follow us there at the Cultural Hall. And let us know what you think. We're always open to the feedback and actually appreciate it. Even if you're sort of trolly in your feedback, I appreciate hearing back from you and knowing what you've got to say. On the phone with us right now, Jason F. Wright. What does the F stand for, my friend?
The F stands for Fletcher, which is my mother's maiden name. Strong family name down in southern Utah.
Yeah, I like it. See, and I sort of like the Fletcher, right? I'm sort of the Chevy Chase, Fletcher, all that kind of thing. You may think about incorporating that a little bit more.
Oh, trust me. I was in high school in the late 80s. Everybody called me Fletch and Fletch Lives when the sequel came out.
Yeah.
So I'm very familiar.
And you got to love that there's a little nod in that movie to the Mormons. So you had it made.
Indeed, indeed. I was the coolest kid in high school. Not.
I'm looking at your picture, and I might contend that. No, I'm teasing. I'm teasing. Jason, you are a writer. You are a Mormon, obviously, as well. And then I want to ask you about this, because I love Wikipedia, and I love what it might bring out about people.
Oh, no.
You are also an actor.
Yeah, but the... Yeah, wow. We started in a dark place, my friend. I thought maybe we'd wind up here half an hour from now, but
nope.
You've gone right to it.
No, let's just get right to it. An actor in the movie Troll 2, which, correct me if I'm wrong, that's not the notorious movie for being the worst movie ever, or is it?
It is frequently referred to as the best worst movie. In fact, there's a documentary by that name, Best Worst Movie, that... another great Utahn, Michael Stevenson, made, who was the star of Troll 2. In fact, Best Worst Movie is a much better film than the movie
Troll 2.
It covers Troll 2, yeah.
How did that happen?
Oh, boy. You know, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time years ago. It's summer of 1989, and I was a freshman at BYU. I'd come out for summer term right after high school graduation, and I was at the... what was then, I think, still called the Osmond Motion Picture Studio there in Provo, to audition for some other church film that was being produced there. And as I walked out, this receptionist at the main desk there at the studio was on the phone gathering information about this audition. They wanted her to spread the word around the studio because somebody had dropped out of the movie and they were trying to cast her really quick. And, and I'm literally walking by the desk as I overhear this conversation, and she hangs up and I start chatting with her, and she's like, yeah, they're reading for this film. It's called Goblins. That's what it was originally called. Mm-hmm. If you can be in Park City in a couple hours, you could probably read for this role. And so I was like, absolutely.
Yeah.
I go home, I bribe my roommate into driving me to Park City, and the rest is horrible, horrible personal history.
Not horrible, Elliot Cooper in Trolls 2, or Troll 2. What a weird sort of scenario, huh?
It is a horrific film. We didn't even get to read the script before we shot. It was, the Deseret News actually ran a great feature on this this fall. I made some incredible friendships. Some of the folks I met on set, I'm very dear friends with today. One of the guys I talk to, a couple times a week still, all these years later, another actor who lives in Utah. But the film itself is just so regrettable. I mean, it's so painful to watch. They were all Italians on set. Nobody spoke much English at all. And it was just, yeah, we had no idea what we were really filming until we saw the finished. In my case, I didn't see the film for a couple of years because I went and served a mission, came home and everybody was talking about this horrible movie, and I was like, oh, I thought that thing had gone away and been buried in a vault in Rome, but no.
Didn't we tuck that away somewhere? Is yours a pretty big part in that movie?
It's big enough that I regret it. It's like in that, there are like four main leads, and then I was one of the next, three
okay,
or four.
Okay.
So I've got enough lines that I wish I didn't have any.
But it has sort of a cult following. So has that been an awesome thing to be a part of, even though it's known as the best worst movie?
Yeah, and fans, particularly, you know, on college campuses around the country, they love the film. And it is, you know, I poke fun at it all the time because it really is that bad. But it has quite a following, not just here in the States, but it's been translated and is available on DVD around the world.
Wow.
Fox, 20th Century Fox, bought the rights to it and released a big double feature with Troll and Troll 2 several years ago that sort of reignited the interest in it. And then HBO bought the television rights at one point, and they just ran it over and over and over. And every day I was getting emails from old high school friends saying, please tell me this isn't you.
This looks like you, but please tell me this is not you.
Yeah. I always say it's not.
Yeah, no. No, that's a different Jason F. Wright. Let me ask you this. You dropped a couple nuggets in there. I want to go back. You served a mission. Where did you serve?
I served in Belo Horizonte, Brazil.
Okay. Give me an idea what that's like.
It's amazing. It's just north and west of Sao Paulo. Kind of in the interior of the country. At the time, the mission border was, it bordered Sao Paulo and Rio to the east, and then went all the way over to the border of Paraguay and Bolivia. Mm. So it was like a 40-hour bus ride from one side to the other. And of course, as the church has grown and missions have grown, it's a little smaller now, but humble people. It's called the state of Minas Gerais, and it's just among the most humble people on the planet. My daughter recently returned from a mission in Florianópolis, mm-hmm. which is also in Brazil, and when she got her call, I just flooded her with stories about what she was going to experience in Brazil and the people and the food and the culture, and her mission was completely different than mine. And other than eating rice, I don't know that she had any experiences or any kind of personal observations about the culture that were anywhere near what I had. So, but I do love the people of Brazil.
Right before she comes home, she's like, "Dear Dad, so remember all that stuff you said? Yeah, didn't happen.
No, everything from the strength of the church to baptisms to everything. She loved it, of course, and it's where she knew she was meant to serve, and she had a lifetime of phenomenal experiences, but they were completely different than my lifetime of phenomenal experiences. So, but that's cool.
Your Wikipedia also mentions that you traveled throughout Europe for some of your life. Talk about that.
So that was as a child. My dad was a civilian working for the army, so we lived in a couple places in Germany, and then almost every weekend got on a train or a bus or a car and drove around Europe to see the sites. We moved to Chicago. So we were there for about 5 years and then mm-hmm. moved to Chicago, spent a couple years. And then my dad got his dream job in Charlottesville, Virginia. And that's where I finished up my growing up years and graduated from high school. And my father since passed away, but my mom and some of my family still live in good old Charlottesville.
I got to know, what's the dream job?
The dream job was, believe it or not, still for the government, but it was this outpost of the Pentagon, kind of a secret location out in the hills of Charlottesville. And it was a really great team. It was, you know, it was a promotion for him. And it was, if you've ever been to Charlottesville, or if any of your folks listening have been to Charlottesville, they know that once you go, you're going to come back. It's a really unique little city.
Okay.
There's a reason Bronco is in Charlottesville, right?
Yeah. And they can keep him as far as I'm concerned. look, we got the better end of that. Oh, that's
too
bad. Did we? We'll see how next season is, right? Third time is the charm. Who knows?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And for people who don't know what we're talking about, BYU football. So there's that.
Yeah.
So I wonder then, how was that experience? You know no other, but going from international to, you know, one place in Chicago to then in Charlottesville, Virginia. What was that like for you growing up, especially with the church?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The church is obviously so different that, you know, what's inside the box is the same. The pearl, as Boyd K. Packer used to say, is the same. But the box looks a little bit different. And certainly, you know, we attended a couple of small branches in Germany. you know, where everyone in the branch is in leadership, and it's a pretty small turnout on Sundays, to a pretty healthy ward in Chicago. And you know, we lived in a very traditional suburban kind of a neighborhood in the Libertyville, Mundelein area. And then moving to Charlottesville, where at the time the church was, you know, relatively small, one ward. We lived out in the boonies, still in the same house my mother's still in today. Hmm. There was a lot of adjustment. I mean, it was right out of a movie. I looked out the back window of our big marshmallow station wagon as we pulled out of Chicago and bawled as my best buddy stood in the middle of the street and waved at me. It sounds horribly pathetic now, but that's exactly how it happened. And I didn't think I'd ever find another friend or another place quite like Chicago, but sure enough did. And we moved to Charlottesville at the right time. The church, despite the arrival of the Wright family, the church really exploded in Charlottesville. And now there are five or six huge wards, and I would guess the stake soon, and lots of great things happening in that community. And it's, you know, you adjust. The Lord takes care of you if you allow him to as you move around the world.
In your travels, have you lived in the state of Utah?
Yeah, so I went to, after the, that summer of 89 and the film experience, I served a mission, came back, and then spent time at BYU, met my lovely wife.
Wait, you met her at BYU? I've never heard of that.
I know. It's very, well, even better. I was dating a roommate. That's probably never happened.
Yeah.
dating a roommate, realized I was dating the wrong girl, traded up big time, and here we are all these years later.
How did you navigate that? That seems to be the gentleman's impossibility.
Well, you know, I don't know if the other young lady is listening or not. She was a lovely, lovely young lady, but it was pretty clear that it was probably not the right fit. But I had been noticing this other very cute young lady that lived in her apartment south of campus there in Provo, and so in the span of about 12 hours, the other young lady and I were done, and I was on a date with now my wife.
Good for you.
Up in Salt Lake, and yeah, we have not looked back since. My wife probably has, but I have not looked back since.
She's like, speak for yourself. And then studying at BYU, what did you study? How did you know what you wanted to do?
You know, it's interesting. I studied history and English. I spent a semester as a theater major, theater and film, because, of course, when you're coming off a hit like Troll 2, you're thinking, this is my big break.
Your big residuals check for cents comes in every once in a while, and you're
I'm getting a SAG card. I'm moving to L.A. I'm going to be the next, you know, Tom Cruise or Johnny Depp back in the day. No, I knew in the third grade I wanted to be a writer. It was just a matter of kind of navigating my way there. I've been involved in lots of other, I mean, I have done everything from the acting world to some commercials to running for Congress to having some small businesses in when we lived in Pleasant Grove. Some of those ended in, you know, colossal failures, but...
Ooh, wait. I want to know.
Well, where should I begin? My wife and I had a singing telegram business. I modeled tuxedos at the mall. I was the Easter Bunny at the mall. I ran a pizza place. I owned a couple of video stores. I owned a couple of internet companies. I ran against Chris Cannon in 2000.
There you go.
for the Republican nomination down in Provo. And again, some of those just were horrible failures on my part, but such great learning lessons. And I've been, to go off on a slightly on another tangent, I grew up in a home where failure was a success. And I never minded losing the foot race or the role in the play or not getting the job or Monopoly with my sister.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just learned how to be a little bit better the next time. And so I've never been afraid to try something and fall on my face, because I think I've gotten pretty good, because I've had so many opportunities to fail.
Yeah.
I've gotten pretty good at learning how to identify the lessons and moving on. So through the years, I was kind of dabbling in all these things and learning who I wanted to be, and maybe most importantly, discovering that we all kind of have a story to tell. And I think heaven expects us to find the right outlet to share who we are and what we believe. And sometimes it's in quiet ways, and sometimes it's, you know, a little bit louder, and sometimes it's, you know, a podcast with millions of people around the world listening, like you've got.
Aww.
So back to school. I just knew, you know, eventually, I'm gonna end up following the advice of my third grade teacher, who said, if you really believe in this, you could be a writer when you grow up. And so when I finally hit my 30s, I grew up.
And now I got to do this. I want to talk about more about what exactly your voice is, what your journey, what your story is. Let's take a break for a second. We'll come back and we'll talk about that in the second block of the Cultural Hall.
Imagine running a small business today. It's challenging. Imaging and internet presence is an absolute must. Even with that, you're still a small star in a bright cyber universe. Now, imagine you have someone who understands how to get your site designed for your talents and then easily searched by potential clients. Imagine Lennon Design. Whether it's strictly a website or a whole package of logo creation, advertising media, and promotional materials, Lennon Design is your partner in business. They'll test the boundaries of their imagination to create something unique for you. When you need creative, affordable design, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
Hi, friends. Dan the Laptop Man here from PC Laptops. I get a lot of emails with feedback from customers. Here's one. Dear Dan, I want to thank you for the help you gave my mom with her computer. She's gone from being frustrated to fascinated. I'm not overjoyed, though, that every picture of me that she has is now on Facebook. But she loves the computer and is happier than I've seen her in her whole life because of your team. You guys are the best. Signed, Happy. Dear Happy, in our company training meetings, we always teach everyone to treat every customer like they're your mom. At PC Laptops, we'll hold your hand every step of the way. Get a brand new PC Laptops desktop for just $799 with a lifetime warranty at any PC Laptops location. $799? You can't beat that. While supplies last, quantities are highly limited. Please visit us at PCLaptops.com. That's PCLaptops.com. I know you'll be happy too. Hey, Ma!
It's time for the second block of the Culture Hall, and discovering your path, right? Finding what it is that your story is. I really love what you said about how in your home, the success was failure. And I think for so many people, that failure is so daunting or so, so intense or so fear-making that it's crippling, it's paralyzing. And it's awesome to see that you just kind of go, yeah, no, I failed so hard at that thing.
Yeah, I think it comes in part, and perhaps your listeners can relate, it comes in part to being the youngest of four, we're with a little bit of an age gap, so 4 years to a sister and six to a brother and almost 10 to my oldest brother. So
let me ask you real quick before we move on from that. Were you a miracle from heaven?
I don't ask my mom that question anymore because the truth is, no, I'm just kidding. No, I was intentionally a girl. That's what my mom tells me.
Okay.
She says, we meant to have you, but we meant to have you in a little pink dress. So I've kind of learned to accept that. No, but it is when you're the youngest in a family of four like that, and I've got, you know, smart and strong-willed and, you know, very, very capable older siblings, you do lose a lot. You lose the foot races and the wrestling matches in the living room and, you know, in the Monday night card game. So, and I just, I don't know, I suppose the Lord's been very kind to me to help me, one, to be okay with that and to no one loves to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a mistake for anyone to think that I just looked for opportunities to come in second. That's certainly not true. But
you're like, cool, look, hey, wait, I'm going to get into that and not do my best or come in very last. Or yeah, no, of course not.
I think I had friends who, particularly in high school, when suddenly you're very, very cool, right? And
mm-hmm. And
you don't want to give a speech that isn't well-received. You don't want to not make the debate team. You don't want to make the football team. And I had some friends who I loved, you know, dearly, but who I felt like were always kind of passing on opportunities because they were afraid to be embarrassed or afraid to, to lose or hear a giggle from the back of the room. And I just, again, I think this is, it's not so much about a talent on my part. It's just a gift from heaven that I was blessed to see it another way and say, what's the worst thing that happens if you don't make the football team? You just,
right.
I mean, you had a great experience. You meet some cool people. You make a new circle of friends, and then you go try something else. You're not going to know really kind of what you're good at. I love when I speak in schools. I speak in elementary and middle schools all over the country, and one of my favorite little object lessons to do is to have a kid come up front and ask them to walk across the stage as if they're learning to walk for the first time. And, you know, they're always silly and fun, and they're looking for laughs from their friends. Mm-hmm. And they come up, and they'll just kind of waddle across the stage. And I'll say, no, I want you to, like, take your first steps like you're just learning to walk. And by the time we kind of get through this five-minute process, they're really getting into it. And they'll take a step or two, and they'll fall flat on their face. Then they'll very awkwardly push themselves back up. And eventually they're walking across the stage. And we talk about how what a great metaphor that is for learning in life. We learn to walk that way because it strengthens our muscles and our core and our legs. And falling is a really important part of learning to walk because you're, a toddler. It's without falling, you would never have the strength to actually get across the room.
Right.
And it's not the falling, right? It's the muscles you use to get back up. And so I think that's just, I fell a lot as a kid, and I learned to push myself back up and keep walking until I found the destination I thought heaven wanted me in.
Well, and so you mentioned that you speak nationally. You know, you said elementary school kids and middle school kids, but you also have arrived at that part where you are a writer.
Yeah, this is what as I said earlier, I had a third grade teacher, Ms. Sampson, who said this is something you could be really good at, and I've heard her voice in my head many times through the years, and so at every stop, even when I was, running a pizza place, I was the guy writing the copy for the menu, or running for Congress, I wrote all my own stuff, and I've written for presidential candidates, and I've ghostwritten for members of Congress. And anytime I could find an opportunity to be the guy writing at whatever job I've had through the years, I leapt at it. And then about 12 or 13 years ago, I said, all right, now I think it's time to see if I can write something under my own byline that's a little bit longer than, a page and a half for a newspaper somewhere. So I kind of crafted my first novella and then another and another and another. And I, Ms. Sampson has long since passed away, but I hope she's somewhere looking down there thinking, you know what, I might have gotten that one right.
I've always wondered, and I probably know it, and as soon as you explain it to me, I'll go, oh, yeah, duh. The difference from a novella to a novel, is there?
Yeah, generally a novel is considered something 50,000 words or more.
Okay.
Like an adult contemporary novel, those tend to run in the 60 to 70,000 word range. You know, if you're thinking like a Nick Sparks or a Grisham, maybe runs a little bit longer. But adult contemporary fiction, modern day, set in 2017, that stuff tends to run kind of in that range. Anything under that, like a Christmas Jars, the James Miracle, another one of my books. A lot of the Christmas books that you'll see at your local bookstore, like the little stocking stuffer books, those tend to be more like in the 30 to 35,000 word range, and those are referred to as novellas.
So it's just a length thing. Huh. Everyone, yeah. Stop. You just learned something. Check that out. You mentioned Christmas Jars. Probably your most popular, would you say?
Yeah, it's certainly the one with the most legs. I think there are about 1 million copies sold since it came out around the world. And it's, grown from a book into a movement. In fact, I'm thrilled that people still want to run out and buy the book. But it's, for me, it's much more about the tradition that it has launched with people filling up jars with change all year long and then finding someone to give it away to anonymously during the holidays. It's been, very gratifying. One of my other novels, The Wednesday Letters, also was a little bit of a surprise hit that I still get mail about, a decade later. But I think the Christmas Jars experience certainly is why I'm probably talking to you today.
1 million copies.
That's a lot of books.
Does that blow your mind? Because you're just a third grader that Mrs. Sampson said, hey, maybe go for it.
Yeah, I know. No, it blows my mind. Every time I get, and even more than just that raw number, which is, pretty darn cool, it's getting emails from people around the world that I've never met, that don't know me, that they weren't conned into buying the book by my mother, who's my greatest, marketing strategist in the world. But just some random person in some small town in Oklahoma who who emails me and says, hey, I found your book at Barnes & Noble. I thought the cover was cool. I bought it, and it changed my approach to celebrating the birth of Christ at Christmas. Like, how do you, a million copies or not, if you sold one book and that was the reaction from a reader, you'd go, all right, Miss Sampson, you were right.
I can't imagine what it would be like to impact a movement like that. As you're writing the book, were there spiritual experiences as things came together?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a big believer in, particularly when you're working in a creative world, that you pray before, I pray during, I pray after. I'm trying to sort of tell stories that I think will draw people closer to him, and the only way to do that is to invite him into the creative process. And I would hope anyone listening who's painting or writing or making movies or whatever you might be doing, if it's particularly if you just feel like it's creative, I mean, God is a creator. I mean, that is ultimately he creates us. We have this drive to create, which President Uchtdorf talked about a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And I just think that inviting heaven into that process helps you to tell stories, whether it's on paper or in a podcast, that invite people to feel just a little bit of his love for them. And so, yes, as I wrote Christmas Jars, I had a number of experiences where, I mean, I cried reading some of my own stuff, which is really weird to admit, but there were some experiences, particularly during editing when the book was, you know, the manuscript was near completed, that I read back through it, and I felt the Spirit and said, you know, this is right. And I'd be lying if I didn't say there were a few moments when I said, this has the potential to be really special. And of course, my family had given a jar away, mm-hmm, as an experiment, long before the book. I hadn't even started page one, and we gave a jar away to kind of change the way we celebrated the holidays and to see what that would feel like. And so as I wrote, I said, I'm trying to create an experience, though it's fictional. I'm trying to create an experience where someone will read the book and go out and do what we did with the jar and bless a family. And if they do, their lives will be changed as ours was.
Is there a specific experience that you had with Christmas Jars or any of your other where you feel like, man, this was spiritually prompted and you can share it with us?
I had an email come in the first year the book was out, and it was from a woman named Sherry in Texas who had gotten a jar, single mom, couple kids, really struggling, and had gotten a jar on Christmas Eve. You know, it was enough money that she could run out, find a store open, because she had nothing. She didn't have a tree. She was able to rush out, get a couple small things, use the rest of the money to, you know, pay her light bill, and she wanted me to know how this mysterious jar and a copy of the book that was taped to the outside of the jar had restored her faith in humanity, because mm-hmm, she felt like no one was seeing her either in this world or in the other. And as I read that, I could feel kind of some satisfaction from my third grade teacher saying, I told you so. Mm-hmm. And then very much the spirit of my own father, who, as I said, passed away when I was 16, and who was even, you know, more than this third grade teacher, was such a believer in my ability to create something that would last. And in many events around the country, particularly when I talk about Christmas Jars, I very much feel my father there continuing to sort of cheer me on and to just remind me to stay humble first and foremost, because I have a lot of friends that write for a living for whom that has become a struggle, and that makes me a little sad. So I can kind of hear my dad saying, stay humble, remember why you're doing this, or I'll smack you in the back of the head when I see you again.
Why do you think it is hard to stay humble with the success?
You know, it's money, and a lot of these guys are making, you know, and I've kudos to them for the success. You know, a million copies is wonderful, but, you know, and there are many authors out there selling 10, 15, 20 million books a year across series, and it's good for them, but it is hard. And I've seen that trap where you walk into a a bookstore and there are 300 people waiting there for you, and they've been waiting for hours to take a selfie with you or have you sign an autograph. And I just think you really have to work to keep that from distracting you from creating and using that gift to create, to, you know, to entertain, to bless. I don't know. I'd hate to get inside any of those other authors' minds. I just know from some personal experience that it can be a challenge. And I tell people all the time at events, if you ever, in fact, my own family knows this for sure, if you ever get the sense that I have gotten suddenly too big for my britches because I've sold a couple of books, sit me down and tell me, because I don't ever want to be that writer who thinks that I have become more important than the messages that I'm trying to share.
I like that. But I also understand that other side of it, right? Like, I mean, there is something about the adoration of 300 people saying, you know, constantly hearing, oh my gosh, so great, this affected me so much, you are so great, all these things. Just, I think that's awesome. You ask family to just hit me straight. If I'm starting to be a jerk, just give it to me.
And I'll offer that to anyone. If you're listening right now and you ever feel like you read something I've written, one of my articles, you've been to a speech, and you ever get the sense that I've forgotten that this isn't about me, this is about what I think are heaven-sent messages to inspire people to feel a little bit of the love of the Savior, then send me a note, hit me on Facebook, and just say, hey, remember why you're doing this, because that's, I would give all this up tomorrow if that's what the Lord asked me to do.
Really? Jeez.
Absolutely.
You know, you talk about the messages and writing and sort of finding your journey. And you've written these books, but you also do news. You write articles for Deseret News. You've done for Fox News, for The Blaze. Let's talk about that for a minute.
You know, that's an kind of a last 4 or 5 years, I just felt like I was often meeting these really interesting people on planes or trains or you know, at events, or somebody would reach out to me online and say, hey, I'd love for you to tell the story of my, you know, my father who was a veteran in World War II or whatever. And I just began to write, you know, these kind of human interest short pieces that were, you know, in the 700 to 800, 900 word range. And I have some experience with that style because I had done a lot of political op-ed work when I worked in politics in D.C. So I'd already, you know, been published in quite a few newspapers around the country and had some relationships, but it was more kind of dry public policy stuff. And so I began to kind of experiment a little bit with a little more of the slice of life kind of writing. And I submitted a couple of pieces just unsolicited to the Deseret News and had a good response. And I said, hey, anytime you have an idea, send it to us. And so for the first year, about every month or so, I'd kick something in. And then one of the editors said, hey, next time you're in Salt Lake, let's sit down. And he's like, would you like to write every week? Like, mm-hmm. if we just gave you a spot and you just, you know, you wrote every Tuesday or every Thursday. And I said, sure, how hard can that be?
Yeah.
And then it turned out, as you know, generating content as frequently as you do, it's tough, and it's always on your mind, isn't it?
Famous last words. How hard can that be? The answer, yeah. Really tough. Really hard.
Yeah, really hard to come up with a new thing every week. So I wrote, you know, I don't know, 250, 300 pieces probably, and then in the last 6 months or so, just as I've gotten, you know, a little buried with church responsibilities and some other, you know, some novels and some films that were getting into development, I got to the point that I said to them and to Fox and some others I was writing for, I'm going to need a little more flexibility to write when I can. So every couple of weeks I do something, and sometimes a month passes, and I'll get an email saying, hey, do you have anything fresh? So, but I just like, again, it's all about finding stories that I'll have something up in the next week or so about a very dear friend of mine whose wife was killed in a car accident last week, 29 years old, 4 little kids, pregnant with a fifth, serving as a primary president of her ward in Front Royal, Virginia, and his whole just response to it and his attitude about, you know, God's plan for us is just so incredibly inspiring. So I'll, you know, spend a couple hours with him and put together a nice little piece that people can read in 5 or 6 minutes on their phone that I hope just invites them to feel a little bit of heaven.
So let's talk about movies and other things that are taking you away from that. What's going on?
So Christmas jars has been in development for quite some time, and we're getting, I think, fairly close to finally crossing the funding finish line, which is, of course, the biggest hurdle in getting films made, is finding people willing to risk a few bucks. But we're getting pretty close there. We're also actually looking to develop a TV series based on the true stories of the Christmas jar. So actually going out and shooting some of these thousands of miracles have come in through ChristmasJars.com through the years of, like I told you, Sherry in Texas, who got on her knees and prayed for a miracle and got one. So we're going to develop a little 10 or 12 episode series for next fall, where every week you'll be introduced to a new family that was the recipient of a jar and how it changed them and how it all came to be. And then the Wednesday Letters, which I mentioned earlier, is probably my second most well-known book, and it's been translated in quite a few languages. That one is also going into development, I think, with our good friends at PureFlix in January, and so we're hoping maybe to have that out in the next year.
Cool. That's got to feel awesome.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming. I mean, Christmas Jars has been it's been about 10 years since we first started working with this team to get it made, so I'm getting old. I'm ready to see that. I'm ready to see that in the theaters.
It's funny to me, as you've talked about Christmas jars. This is terrible where my mind goes. You know the Christmas shoes song? That song just rings in my head, and I want there to be like some sort of correlation, which there isn't. But you're like Christmas jars, and like I want to feel these Christmas jars. So
you know
I put
cut
my
that.
Money
you
in.
Cut that track. I like it.
Yeah, I don't know. That's just a little peek inside my brain where you're like, oh man, I don't want to live in that space.
You know, it's funny though. I met with I was in Heber City a couple weeks ago, and I met with Michael McLean, who's pretty familiar. I would guess his name is familiar to a lot of your folks.
Yeah,
and he's got some really cool ideas for a Christmas Jars musical that we might try to develop as well over the next year. He's, of course, so well-known for Forgotten Carols, and millions of people have seen Forgotten Carols through the years. So.
Oh, and they are trudging that right now, for sure. That has started, and you see the billboards, and, you know, the books are out again, and you can get the soundtrack everywhere here in Utah with that already.
Yeah, he's and good for him. He is a creative mastermind, and I love that 20 years later people are still lining up to buy tickets to see that show. That just makes my day.
Are you a part of the secret Mormon society of creative people that you can't tell me about but that exists?
Yes. I evidently it's so secret that I'm not allowed to tell you that I don't know it exists.
I knew it the whole time. I have long speculated that all you creative folks, you bestsellers and, you know, multi-track, you know, all these selling guys, all get together casually like best friends in a world that most people aren't allowed to be a part of. And it's like, oh, my best friend, Michael McLean. And, you know, I know it's there. I know you won't admit to it. I know that it's a secret society. And one day,
well,
maybe, right?
I will tell you that there is a cool camaraderie among creators that are members of the church, and I think it stems from what we discussed a little bit earlier about this shared belief that we're creating in the same pattern that God creates, and we're just trying to create a little bit of goodness. And I can tell you my non-member friends that write or make films or entertain in some way, they're much less likely to go to lunch and share ideas with what they're working on. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sitting at, I'll name drop for you, I'm sitting at lunch with Michael McLean, and the piano guys walk in, and they just start sharing ideas with Michael and back and forth and the projects they're working on. And, you know, we're taking photos and talking like I've never met them. I had, you know, I was as starstruck as anyone. My kids were thrilled I got to meet the piano guys and a little bit jealous. But they walked out, and Michael and I sat there and talked about this very thing, that there's just Latter-day Saints who create are very generous with their time and ideas, and what are you working on, and what am I working on, and how can we help one another?
Awesome. I want to take a break for a second. We'll come back, and we'll wrap this thing up in the third block of the Cultural Hall.
The Cultural Hall wants you to help Utah Food Bank fight hunger statewide. Through your donations of food, time, or money, Utah Food Bank is able to distribute over 31 million meals annually to Utahns facing hunger. Even a $1 donation can be turned into $7.35 of goods and services. 1 in 5 children in Utah could go to bed hungry tonight, and 423,000 Utahns are unsure where their next meal will come from. By donating food at your local pantry or by visiting utahfoodbank.org, you can make a difference.
Hey everyone, it's Brother Kyle from the Cultural Hall host panel here for backcountry.com and competitivecyclist.com. It's where I work, and what we do is sell awesome gear for anything that you do outdoors. We're actually located right in Utah, the outdoor sports capital of the world, and we carry gear for camping, skiing, running, fly fishing, biking, kayaking, surfing, all that stuff, and a lot more. Super cool active clothing, tons of great stuff for Christmas, like your winter gear, coats, gloves, boots, all by the top brands in the industry. I want you to go to backcountry.com or competitivecyclist.com for the bike stuff and check us out. And then call me 801-204-4699 or email Kyle Brown at backcountry.com and I will hook you up with special deals. So much cool stuff. Amazing deals from me. You'll swear it's a miracle.
It's time for the third block of the Cultural Hall. Jason Fletcher, the Fletch Lives Right. And you are a part of this huge campaign, the Light the World, hashtag Light the World. What are you doing with it?
You know, first of all, I just have to say, I have wanted to be a part of this in some small way since the beginning.
You're talking about the Cultural Hall, I presume. No, I'm just joking.
Absolutely. No, the church's annual initiative. I think this is the second year they've called it Light the World. I think in previous years it was...
Because of him or something like that?
Yeah, because he lives or because of him or something. And clearly they've done, they've just had tremendous success over this last year or two with Light the World. And I think your friend, actually, the one that introduced us, John Dye at Bonneville Communications, is the one that reached out to me and asked me if I wanted to do something. And I honestly just leapt at the opportunity. I just feel like, I know because I live out here in Virginia where most of my friends and neighbors are not members of the church, that they really respond to this kind of content. And what a beautiful way to remind the world that more than anything at all, we believe in the birth, the death, and the resurrection of the Savior Jesus Christ, and it starts with the birth. And I'm thrilled to have an opportunity to introduce people a little bit to what we believe about the Savior. And this thing I've been doing, you know, I love these. Salt Lake is one of my favorite places to visit, and I've done a number of these homeless and hitchhiker videos. I call it hashtag giving a lift. And I put someone who's homeless or a hitchhiker, and I give them a ride. I put them in my car, and I set up a camera, and we just talk about their life and what they've been through and why they're hitchhiking or why they're homeless or how long they've been homeless. And so what we're going to do during the month of December here is have a special episode dedicated to the Light the World program, and we're going to invite that person in my car to get out of the car with me and to go do something and to provide a little bit of service for the service that they received, and I'm excited to be a part of it.
You know, it's an awesome campaign because sometimes I fear that as members of the church we can be a little bit heavy-handed or we are so different or, you know, any number of those things. And I really like the way you put it, right? Because at the core, first and foremost, we believe in the Savior, and that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, and you know, as people express interest and want to talk about some of the more unique pieces of our beliefs, I'm more than happy to do that. Mm-hmm. But that's not a conversation that we need to lead with. Let's talk about what brings us together, especially this time of year. My goodness, we should be talking about the core of Christianity, which is Christ. And I have so many friends that belong to other churches here in Virginia that are the most remarkable and pure and loving Christians. And how can I not reach out to them and love them despite the fact that they go to a church with a different steeple on Sundays?
And with the Light the World campaign, like, I love that it not only allows us to focus on the Savior, but it also allows us in small but very measurable ways to do things for other people and challenges us to do things for other people and encourages us and recognizes us too. I just think it's a brilliant campaign, and I'm excited not only to see what you do with it, but anyone listening to this, if you haven't checked out the hashtag Light the World, there are, you know, there are some really amazing huge feats that people do, and some really just basic sweet things that people do.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be complicated, does it? I mean, if you're, you know, if your kid volunteers to go shovel snow at the widow's driveway across the street, follow him over, and when he's not looking, snap a photo and post it on Instagram or Facebook and hashtag Light the World. That's all you have to do. You don't have to shoot a film. You don't have to edit something. You don't have to spend a lot of money. Just generate cool content and tag it that way and make a difference.
And you were talking before we turned the microphones on about one of the experiences that you recently shared, just kind of along these lines, yeah?
Yeah. I've had some just incredible experiences with homeless people in the car and hitchhikers in the car. And soon I'm going to be actually creating, I don't know. Do we give too much away? I mean, your people are very curious. Do we keep them hanging for a little bit longer?
Well, listen, it's up to you. I just set it up so that you could either spike it or say, stay tuned and you'll let them see. It's up to you.
Yeah, look, hit facebook.com, look for JFW Books, or just search Jason F. Wright, and we're gonna have a lot of fun over the coming weeks with someone in my car performing a little bit of service. It's gonna be cool.
Okay, all right, I'll take that tease. We ask everyone who steps here into the Cultural Hall a few questions, and so I want to ask those of you now. Earlier, you alluded to that church has been keeping you a little bit busy. Our first question we ask everyone is, do you have a calling? And if so, what is it?
I do have a calling. I am currently serving as the Bishop of the Woodstock Ward in the Winchester, Virginia stake.
So that's a considerable amount of time.
It's a little bit of time. It's a little, but I love it.
And you got the tithing settlements coming up.
Yes, thank you for reminding me. I've got to get going on that.
have you put the sign-up sheet on the outside of your door yet? Because
you do know your Mormon tradition, don't you? Actually, we're in a really unusual situation. In just 10 seconds, we're not having our regular meetings are happening at the Stake Center because our building is being renovated. So we drive about 40 minutes. Some of in our ward drive more than an hour to get to church every Sunday. So we're having to be a little creative with how we're going to do tithing settlement because it's not the typical situation every week.
Do it online. Closed circuit online. No, I don't know.
Oh, amen to that.
In fact, church that way, if you would, Bish. Let's let's stream it into our homes. We'll do pajama church, and we'll find a way to fellowship and strengthen each other still.
Don't we do that in October and April already? What is that weekend?
And
I love
don't
that weekend.
And don't you love it?
I do love it.
So a couple more times a year, can we, you know?
Maybe quarterly. Just negotiate.
Yes. Nice January and right around the 24th of July. Let's just do that.
You've got more influence than I do, my friend. Yeah. You should, if you're listening right now and you can make this happen.
Yeah. President Monson, are you listening? Let's take that. So Bishop of the Ward. Is that something you ever wanted to do? Because it sounds, in all respect to the calling, it sounds terrible.
Yeah, it's anyone who ever wishes or lobbies or campaigns for that calling ought to get it, because it is on the one hand the most challenging thing I've ever done in the church, and on the other it's a tremendous blessing. There is nothing quite like sitting across from someone in great pain and helping them access the atonement through priesthood keys, and so I certainly don't want to diminish the blessing that is to be that friend and priesthood leader for them, but it's hard. It's hard. I was in the stake presidency in my prior calling as a counselor, and was released when the stake was reorganized, and had about 2 weeks to kind of take a deep breath and wait for the bishop to call to put me in the nursery, and then all of a sudden they called me as bishop. So, but it's more than anything, it's a blessing to know the members as well as I do, and there aren't finer saints than the ones in my ward.
It's funny to me, yeah, absolutely no sort of disrespect or anything like that, but I had a really great friend of mine from college who he got called as a bishop, and then I didn't see him for, you know, a year or 18 months, right? Because you're busy. And I see him, and the next time I saw him, he had dropped like 25 pounds. And I'm like, are you okay? And he's like, I just worry. I worry and love and care and work and, you know, and I just was like, but you can't do this too much longer or there won't be much left of you. So, you know, insist on the 5-year being released kind of thing. And to me, I just like it is an amazing type of person who can do that calling, because I don't know that I could. I know the Lord qualifies and I'm not going to get into all that, but I look at that and go hard.
Well, if anyone is interested, you can search out a piece I wrote about a month ago called What You Don't Know About Your LDS Bishop. It's I think it's on LDS Living. It's probably the easiest place to find it. And I talk a little bit about that and mostly how imperfect bishops are. And we make mistakes like the rest of you. We're doing work we didn't ask to do, but that we were called to do for a season in your life. And we need your prayers as much as you need ours.
If you could pick a calling for yourself, either one that exists or make one up.
Ward mission leader.
Yeah?
I will interrupt you. Ward mission leader. I just met with my missionaries on Sunday and said, will you please write a letter to Salt Lake, get me released so that I can be the ward. I actually have a phenomenal ward mission leader right now, but that has always been the calling that I have coveted, and that has been the calling I've never had.
Interesting.
I'd love it.
I love that you're like, no, I'm not even going to let you finish the question there.
Yeah, I'm good. I know where you're going. Call me, mission leader, right now.
The last question that we ask everyone is, what is your favorite part of your faith?
My favorite part of my faith, that is a wonderful question. That is a new one. That is a unique one. Noodling that one over, I think my favorite part of my faith is that we believe, and I believe, that the Savior of the world truly knows me, and that for Latter-day Saints, and for me in particular, because the question was about my faith, is that the Lord is so perfect and all-knowing and loving that he chooses to know me in a deeply personal way, where I am, what I'm doing, what I'm thinking, where I'm headed, why I'm suffering, why I'm sad. And he has, because he knows me so well, he has every single answer if I will but ask and then be patient to work on his time and not mine. And many of my Christian friends of other churches, I think they believe, certainly they believe in the Savior of the world, but I'm not sure. And this is maybe one of those unique things about our faith. I'm not sure they fully appreciate how intimately the Savior knows them, too. It's not just Mormons that the Savior loves and knows and cares for and hears their prayers. It's all of us, and I love that about my faith.
Awesome. Where can people send emails of you being a schmo to, or how can people reach out to you?
They can hit me online at jasonfwright.com, or just Google Jason Wright. I pop up pretty quick, or on Facebook at facebook.com/JFW Books, Instagram, Jason F. Wright, Twitter, Jason F. Wright. You Google me, you'll find me, and I respond to every email and every message. And if you want to write me, my mailing address is P.O. Box 669, Woodstock, Virginia, 22664. I'll say that again. P.O. Box 669, Woodstock, Virginia, 22664. I answer by hand every single letter I get in my mailbox. I would love to hear from you.
And that's pretty rare anymore as far as the snail mail. I hate that term, but, you know, everyone knows what I'm talking about.
I get a lot of mail that way, because one of my books is about letter writing, and so I get a lot of mail, and I love it, and I will answer you back.
That's amazing. What a commitment to the folks. And you know that, obviously, with the schmo, I'm just joking. You'll undoubtedly get more letters of, you know, how much you have changed my life or given me a different perspective, and I think that's awesome. Especially,
well, very much appreciate that. I will tell you, some lady from Phoenix, Arizona, sent me a letter last year telling me how much she hated one of my books, and she just wanted me to know that. And so I sent her a check back for $20 and said, "Here, take this and do something good with it." And she never cashed my check. So, but I anxiously await hearing from you.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You keep checking it. You're like, all right, let's see. Is she going to? No? That's awesome.
Still no. I keep waiting.
Well, we hope that this episode has nourished and strengthened your body, and that if you weren't healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week, and that when the time comes, you'll be able to travel home in safety. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat.